Good to go.
All right. The meeting has been called to order at 4:02, and we're ready for the roll call, please.
Miller.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Wendt.
Here.
Donaldson.
Here.
Struthers. Absent.
All right. You have seen the agenda and the minutes. Are there any changes or additions to the agenda or minutes? Okay. Hearing none, those will stand approved. And now it's time for public comments. It's a time for members of the public to offer comments concerning matters not scheduled to be heard tonight at the Planning Commission. Any comments from the public? All right. And we have no old business tonight, correct? All right, we're on to new business then. And we'll start new business with SUB 01-15, Chicagua Bend subdivision.
I don't know if the applicant's here. I was hoping they would be so I could get a good pronunciation on that, because we're not even necessarily sure how to say it. But
okay.
We'll and just we'll call it the subdivision for now.
All right, we'll hear a summary of the staff report then.
It is an interesting name, but that's good. So, yes, this SUB 0115, the first subdivision of 2015, the subdivision, the property owners being Dean Russa and Carol Jacobs Peck. General property location, it's an area of land that is north of West Riverside Road, southeast of the Skunk River, and about 300 feet west of Purvis Lane. Size of this area, it's about 8.5 gross acres, a little over 7.25 net. Zoning, a little interesting piece of property here, and I'll show you on the plat here, but we have three zoning district, I believe. This is one of maybe five parcels in the entire county that has three zoning districts on it, but it has the A1 agriculture, R1 transitional residential, also includes a greenbelt conservation buffer that is generally, I believe, 300 feet around the Skunk River. Property is classified as a residential use as it does contain a single-family dwelling that was constructed in 1895. Looking at the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, that does designate this area as rural transitional residential. It does include some natural areas as well. Those are mainly around the Skunk River, and it is within 2 miles of the city of Ames. This is the map that was sent out to surrounding property owners. There we go. The property outlined here in blue. You see Ada Hayden Park in the city of Ames. Here, this is Highway 69 Grand Avenue right here in West Riverside Road. And you can see the Skunk River kind of meandering through that area. This is a minor subdivision plat. It is a subdivision plat to divide one current parcel into three lots and two outlots. Looking at the zoning on this property, I think some of you were on the commission when this rezoning came through, but back in 2013, the area that is zoned in the R1 was approved with two conditions, one condition being to work with the Story County Environmental Health Department to evaluate the septic system for the existing single-family dwelling prior to development of the site. As per this agreement, we do define development as when the houses actually start getting built, when the earth starts getting moved. So just this approval of this particular subdivision does not signify development. However, that's obviously going to come in the future, and the property owner will be required to work with environmental health prior to that happening. Lastly, the second condition that just maintained that the Greenbelt Conservation Zoning District that was in place was to be unchanged. The Planning and Zoning Commission does provide a recommendation on minor plats to the Board of Supervisors. The City of Ames also has jurisdiction over this subdivision plat according to our adopted 2080 agreement, and the City Council of Ames did approve this subdivision plat last Tuesday, January 27th. Plat is on the screen here above. I'll try to kind of point out a few areas on here. First of all, this lot 3 area, the main large area, that is going to be where the existing single-family dwelling is going to be. There's a piece of ground that is just to the east of that single-family dwelling where those two new lots are going to be located. You see the two outlots in the back here. Those were put there twofold. One reason, the floodplain area and the drainage easement that's being dedicated to Story County to keep any building out of that and secondly, to meet our width-to-depth ratio on our lots. Our width-to-depth ratio says that you cannot have a lot three times an X, or the depth cannot be three times the length of the width. So they had to kind of make some modifications to meet those on those lots right there. Either that or go through a waiver. Again, they chose just to dedicate out lots in areas that really aren't going to be buildable for many reasons. The zoning, that R1 zoning district line pretty much follows the line between lot 2 and lot 3 here to the east. The A1 is all the other area, and you can see kind of a dotted line around here. And if you've got a copy of the plat, you can probably see that better. But really, the Greenbelt District just kind of follows the Skunk River around that area. And there's also some floodplain as well on there that's shown on there. Again, all the floodplain on this property is located in these two new development lots. All the floodplain is located in these outlots, so there will be no building that takes place in the floodplain. And again, just for the commission's sake, we do define an outlot in our ordinance as us not being able to issue zoning permits in those outlots. So if somebody comes in and says, hey, we want to build an accessory building in these outlots, we'll say no because we don't have the authority to do that. Going through some just our general comments, first of all, there were no protective covenants that were submitted with this subdivision. Our assumption is that there will not be any covenants recorded with this subdivision. We did not receive a letter from the fire chief or letters from the appropriate utility providers. This is kind of up to the commission, but if you want a recommendation from staff, we would say based on the size of this subdivision, those letters probably are not necessary, as we would assume there's going to be no problems providing services to this plat, especially based on the area that it's located in. We're not putting in any new roads. There will be one shared access driveway to both of those lots. So as far as getting emergency vehicles in there, getting utilities extended, there should not be any problems. Based off that, it appears that this plat does meet all other requirements to be processed as a minor subdivision plat, and because of that, we would recommend approval. Looking at the comments from our interagency review team, there was a few comments in there. If you had a chance to look at those, I'll quickly just go through them. The assessor's office just gave their normal comments. Scott Wall from the auditor's office noted that with the submittal of the plat, there was a page missing. We did get that plat. That was just kind of a screw-up on our end between the city of Ames when they forwarded the plat onto us after approval. There was concerns from emergency management on possible development within the floodplain or near a floodplain. As I mentioned, there will be no development in the floodplain. Depending on what your definition of near is, there could be development near the floodplain. Margaret James, she noted again with the soils professional that has to be hired to evaluate the soil for the subdivision lots for the new septic systems. And she did also note that the current septic system for that house does not have a functional system, according to her. And then the City of Ames offered comment that the City Council did. Well, it was on. When we got the comment, they said that it was on their 27th agenda. I further received notification from the city that they did approve it. We did have notification letters mailed out to surrounding property owners on January 28th. I believe there were two comments that we received via email that I believe Kristen provided to you this evening, if you've had a chance to look through those. We did also have one individual call in and just kind of voice some comments. The comments all seem to be the same. They deal with traffic on West Riverside Road. If you've ever been in that area, the speed limit's 35. It seems like there's constantly a concern of cars traveling too fast through that 35-mile-per-hour area. Our engineer did note those concerns kind of through this whole process when we worked on the rezoning and the subdivision. That's one of the main reasons why we have a shared access driveway here, because he did not want to permit any additional driveways any more than we had to. So utilizing a shared access driveway between the two lots was the most reasonable thing to do. But other than that, again, I would remind the commission that this zoning was approved back in 2013. The zoning is essentially what has permitted the use of the new lots, as long as they can meet minimum lot size, which they do. So the subdivision plat is just the next step in getting these done. And with that, the alternatives are on the screen here above. And if there are any questions from staff, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thanks.
Yes, let me get back to that here. They're both I believe, right around the 1 acre size. And if you give me a second here, I'll actually pull up the plat in a more readable document for you. If you see here, lot two is proposed to be 1.21 acres. When you net out the right-of-way, it's actually 1.1 net acres. Lot one being 1.08 acres total. When you net out the right-of-way, 0.97 acres. Minimum lot size is 25,000 square feet. That's approximately, if I remember right, 0.46 acres. So about double the size that we require.
The driveway will be between those two.
Yep, you can see the kind of box here between the two lot lines. That's the shared access easement.
Okay, now these septic systems, each one of those has to have their own septic system.
Yes.
And what was the comment about that the septic system in lot three is?
Yep, there's an existing house on lot three here. The house was built in 1895, and according to the Environmental Health Department, it has a non-functional septic system. What non-functional means, I can't tell you. It's probably just an old system and probably needs updating.
I have some information about that because we had one.
Okay.
We did update, or I wouldn't speak up. It was in a third generation home, so our septic system. The septic system, when we moved there, we had a septic tank, but we had no field. And so the septic tank just drained through some tiles, which eventually went into some subterranean, and so it was classified as dysfunctional. It actually functioned very well. We wouldn't have even known it was dysfunctional, but that's why. It's something like that.
Sure.
The drainage is.
And Kristen can probably speak to this, as she is paid half by the Environmental Health Department, but I know there are quite a few septic systems that are very similar to this in the county, and it's a constant concern that Margaret Janes brings up, and something that hopefully we can try to.
Well, if theirs is like what you described on lot three, then where is it flowing to? You see what I'm saying?
I would have my assumptions. I would imagine it's just going to the river, but
yes,
that's.
I would guess that too.
I can't tell you that for fact, but
for sure, because the new tile might just go way down to some system subterranean below that.
Does that in any way impact what we're deciding tonight?
No.
There's no regulatory trigger here that gives the county opportunity to.
With the conditional rezoning agreement, it does state, again, that they have to work with Story County Environmental Health to evaluate the septic system for the existing single-family dwelling prior to any development of this site. The property owners, the current applicants of this, have signed this agreement. So prior to any building permits being taken out for those other lots.
That was part of the rezoning.
Yep,
though, correct.
Yep, but it was taken care of during the rezoning, and we'll enforce that prior to that. The unfortunate thing in this situation, and hopefully they're during title searches and everything, when these lots are sold, this agreement will come up in those title searches as the agreement's been recorded. But if it doesn't come up, a future owner of lot two may come to us and we may say you have to wait until your neighbor updates their septic system. But the Mrs. The Russa and Carol Jacobs Peck, they've been pretty good to work with. So, I'll remind her of this agreement and make sure they get on there. Hopefully it gets taken care of.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, in our case, because it was a third generation home, nobody had ever bought or sold. So we just kept inheriting it until everything was grandfathered in. So we did not have to update.
Mm-hmm. Now, yours is out in the country, too.
Yes.
You don't have a whole lot of people within a half a mile.
Right.
Right?
That's right. But we're still
That's different here. These two people that are here, can you point out where they live?
No, I can't. I'll be quite honest. 546 West Riverside Road would be on the other side of the road. It would probably be, my assumption would be, one of these lots right here would be 546. The other person, she says, as a resident living on West Riverside Road directly across from the proposed subdivision, assume that we're probably dealing with these lots right here. But no, I honestly didn't look up that information prior to the meeting. And I know the other comment that I told you that we received over the phone, that lady lives on Purvis Lane, which is kind of down here in this area. So
it's at the top of the hill.
Purvis Lane? No, Purvis Lane is actually pretty much on about halfway down the hill. It's a really small subdivision. Right. It almost looks like a private drive when you're going down there.
Where does Lot 3 take access?
Lot 3 has a current access. I can't tell you exactly where it is, but it's somewhere in this area right here.
The engineer didn't express any concern about distance between the...
No, because...
Is that a new entrance for Lot 1 and 2? Or
yes, that'll be a new entrance. The reason being here, we technically have a 300-foot spacing requirement. The engineer's allowed to waive that requirement in a lot of instances. There's so many driveways down in this area mm-hmm. that obviously we're not meeting the 300 feet in multiple areas. So,
and that's an engineering
yeah.
decision?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, but Darren has looked this over. Our county engineer has looked this over and is satisfied that they've met all his recommendations. The one thing I will add, too, is that this is one of the, I think, the only areas in unincorporated Story County where we actually have curb and gutter on our roads. So they're going to have to do curb cuts and everything to get the
right.
driveways in, which is pretty unique for an unincorporated subdivision. So,
I just looked it up on my phone. 546 West Riverside is, I think, in Lot 2, which is just south of Lot 1 there. So it's back.
Oh, okay. Yep, that's right. There is kind of a shared access that goes back to there.
Right.
Yep.
Other questions for staff from the commission?
What are all three of those lots currently zoned out? Are they all R1?
No, R1 is Lot 1 and Lot 2.
Okay.
A1 is Lot 3. You can the lot line between them is right here, and if you look just to this dotted line right here is the R1 zoning boundary. The actual subdivision line and the zoning line don't match up perfectly. There's probably a foot or two between the two, but all these lots are going to be located in the R1 district. These two, I should say, Lot 3 will remain A1.
And why is that one still?
That, during the rezoning process, that was what the applicant had requested, mainly because I think the R1 district, when you get in there, the more residential zoning requirements discount a lot of uses that I think they wanted to maintain on their property. So that was the request that they brought forward, was just to rezone that box. And during the deliberation on that, there was never any change to it. So.
And Ames already approved all this as is. They
yep.
didn't have any concerns or reservations.
I mean, the city of Ames has their they put what the general covenants on the subdivision, more or less, saying that future lot owners, if annexation is ever requested by the city, they can't say no to annexation. They have to pay for all extensions of utilities, yada, yada, yada. It's more of a way for the city of Ames to kind of get some control over that if they ever do grow. And I believe those covenants have been signed by the property owner. But that's something between the property owner and the city of Ames. The county would never enforce any of that.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, I mean, we have the only feedback that we've gotten from any of the neighbors are that they don't like the division into the three lots.
Well, then the traffic issue.
I mean, that's traffic issue, but I mean, the only, I think the traffic issue is almost a separate problem from this. I've driven that road between, I live in Northwest Ames, and I used to go that way to get to Danfoss, and that road is hazardous.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, one of them said that they didn't like it divided into two lots because big lots because they wanted to feel out in the
right.
area, and so they didn't like the fact that here comes the little bitty lots,
mm-hmm.
which.
Relatively speaking,
yeah.
an acre is still not a little bitty lot.
What's the surrounding zoning in that?
Most of it's R1 on mainly on the south side of Riverside Road there. It's all R1. There is some pockets of A1 zoning in there. When zoning was adopted for the county, there was a buffer of R1 zoning that went around Riverside Road but didn't go completely around Riverside Road, and I'm not exactly sure why that reasoning was, but if you look through, there's kind of pockets of A1 zoning within this R1, something that we've always been aware of, and we hope to get changed at some point in the future to maintain some consistency, but there's a process we have to go through to get that done.
So the fact that many of those lots in the area are relatively large is a subdivider choice, not a not a regulatory.
And I would point out two things on that. Obviously, again, I've mentioned what the minimum lot size requirement for the R1 zoning is. That's 25,000 square feet. These meet that. The Ames Urban Fringe Plan also requires that they subdivide at a density between 3.75 units per acre and 1 unit per acre. So when the city of Ames reviewed it, they may, based off the size of the parcel, there's 8 acres in here total. If you look at that, we're saying that you have to have between 24 houses and 8 houses. Well, then you can also net out a lot of ground, mainly undevelopable ground, and that's where they got down to, I think, roughly it was about 3.2, 3.1 acres, which still didn't necessarily meet that. From what I've heard from the city of Ames, they looked at that and said, realistically, there just is no way to get a fourth lot on this parcel here, and it's unrealistic to think we can get that fourth lot in there, so they were okay with the 3 lots.
The minimum lot size for R1 is 25,000 square feet. So these lots could have conceivably been quite a bit smaller or divided into more lots.
And another thing, too, is that even furthermore in the R1 zoning district, and we don't deal with this too often, so I need to look it up, but there is a provision that states if they're on a shared septic system, that they can get down to 10,000 square feet lots if they're on a common septic system, so which would obviously be possible in here to do that because of the pretty dense lot, but they're not proposing that. So,
and I assume Story County is prepared to accept the dedication of the outlots, that that's not?
No, the outlots actually are going to be, and there was a note on here that outlots A and B lie entirely. Okay, that's not what I was looking for. Where is it? Outlot A is to be conveyed with Lot 1. Outlot B is to be conveyed with Lot 2. What we will take is the drainage easement, which is 100 feet off the property line, and that's meant for if there's ever any channel improvements that need to be done along the river there, that conservation is able to go in and do that with that easement.
Okay. Other questions from the commission?
I noticed that there's a note from the auditor's department that the survey was incomplete.
What happened was there was, when we received it, and this is here, is we received this particular document right here, which is only one page. There's actually a second page to it that gives the legal description. We've got that copy, and upon recording, the recorder will just make sure that second page is in there.
Do you have a signed copy of the plat yet?
No.
Does that bother you?
If you want to... I don't want to get too far into this. Okay, so we stopped accepting recorded documentation, all the documentation that goes with the subdivision plat. You have the consent, the treasurer's certificate, the auditors. We quit accepting all that with plats. We just said, just give us a subdivision plat. We'll give you a resolution. We need to work on changing that again because it's not working. We're hoping, we have some ideas, kind of what we're thinking is maybe getting all the recorded, all the signed documentation from them ahead of time, keeping it in our office, and then releasing it once everything's been approved, just maintain some consistency. So know in the past we haven't had the signed document, but again, the recorder's always made sure before it gets recorded that you have that signed plat. There's obviously concern, that changes can be made between today and tomorrow, and nobody knows about it, and that's why we need, not that that's happening, but we just need to make sure it doesn't.
Not only that, and this is really splitting hairs, and this is unlikely to ever happen, but we're taking the surveyor and engineers, their signature is what tells us that the information we are making this decision on is accurate.
Yeah.
And so the argument has always been, well, a preliminary plat, what does it matter?
Yeah.
Right? But this is a final plat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a preliminary and final together, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to me that at some point you got to commit and sign your name to the work.
Should be some blood in the game.
Yeah,
I can tell you we had this conversation at our last interagency review team with the auditor and the recorder. We're going to continue to discuss this. You'll probably be seeing some changes to our ordinance by about summertime.
And maybe it's as simple as saying that when it goes to be recorded, it needs to be signed, mm-hmm. but it has to be consistent with what we approved.
Yep.
I mean, just some simple statement like that. But
I don't know. I like Charlie's idea. I'd like to see when it comes for approval, it's finalized.
Yeah.
It's good to go.
I don't want to approve something that is potentially in flux and then.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep, we're working on that. I can assure you of that.
Yeah, but we can make that part of the conditional approval too, that it be signed. How would we remove that one?
Let's cross that bridge when we come to the point of making motions. Any other commission comments or questions? Okay, then we will open up the floor to any public comments. If you have a comment, we'd ask you to go to the podium, state your name and your address for the record. And before I open it up to those in the room here, let's just note for the record that we have a comment submitted by email from J. Elaine Heiber, or Heber, and we also have a comment submitted from Shirley J. Wood at 546 West Riverside Road. I won't read those, but those have been noted. Okay.
Also note that Charlie did mention that there was another phone call received in relation.
And that was from Anna Lamp. I don't know her address, but it is on Purpose Lane.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Comments? All right. Thank you. All right. Any additional questions of staff? Then at some point, before we get too much further into discussion, we'd love to hear a motion, but if there's any clarifications you need, now's the time.
Can you put the alternatives back up there, please?
Sure can.
Nancy, in answer to your question, my feeling would be that a condition just stating that the signed copy of the final plat be consistent with what we've reviewed is
the same
a pretty decent catch-all.
Not consistent with the same as what we reviewed.
Well, an editorial change, is not a big deal, but otherwise, it's going to have to be a signed copy. You can't. I mean, somebody has to sign off that it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
I mean, the likelihood of a change happening or trying to get slipped past this is pretty slim, but I'm just saying it's good practice, I think.
I agree. It's good practice.
I will note, too, that Stumble and Associates, from a surveying standpoint, have been great to work with, and I would have absolutely no concern of that ever happening. But when you're looking at the big picture, there's some surveying companies that we don't work with nearly as much, and, again, that's why we need to look into this. So,
quite certain that if Stumble were here, they'd walk up and sign it right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think attaching that note would be appropriate. Any other questions, or in lieu of questions, a motion?
Alternative number two, the condition being the discussed signing of the documents.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Donaldson, a second by Wendt. Roll call vote.
Smith.
No.
Miller?
No.
Donaldson?
Yes.
Wendt?
Yes.
Steele?
Yes.
Do you want to know why I said no? Okay, I didn't. When I'm reading through those up there, I don't see anything about the septic system, and that concerns me because these lots are going to be flooded. And that concerns me. If it was out in the middle of the country, like Susan is or I am, okay, it would be no big deal. But that concerns me, and that there's not a condition up there to make sure that that is taken care of, so that it does not impact, possibly even in the near future, what's going on. Because when you put additional septic tank systems in, it could possibly even impact those folks across the road. So, you know, I said no because I think there should be a condition, just like, what's her name? Margaret James. Margaret James pointed out with the septic system. I think that the septic system on lot 3 needs to be up to code prior to approval.
Thanks, Nancy. I should have. I did not leave room for discussion after that motion. I apologize for that. So, all right. Let's move on to item number 8. This is a public hearing because we're considering a public hearing item because we are considering an ordinance change. This is ORD 02-15, permitted accessory uses. And staff, what do you have for us?
Quick, what I'll do is I'll kind of, well, I shouldn't say quick, but we'll take some time. There's six areas that we focused on with this review. And again, this comes from our 2015 work program. One of the items in our work program was to review our current allowed accessory uses, make sure we're where we need to be and recommend any changes. So I'm going to go through, I believe everybody has got a copy of the memo that I put together kind of more in-depth detailing these. However, I'll just kind of summarize each one of them. First of all, accessory buildings on adjacent lots. The problem that we've been running into here is that in the past, subdivisions, Bellawood subdivision, recent subdivision that we approved, this is a pretty good example, although the issue has not come up yet. Three or four of the lots in that subdivision, I should say about 8 of the lots in that subdivision are owned dually. They own 2 adjacent subdivision lots. They build their house on one lot. They have green space on the other lot. In the past, not in this subdivision, but in other subdivisions, what happens is people come in and say, I want to put up an accessory building, but I want to put it on this adjacent lot. Well, unfortunately, our ordinance defines an accessory building as a use on the same lot, parcel, or tract. So we can only permit an accessory building as long as it's on that same lot that the principal building, the single-family dwelling, is on. In the past, to alleviate this, what we have done is we've told property owners that, yes, you know, we can probably find something to do, some way to make this work. You're going to have to do a subdivision plat on your current 2 lots and combine them into 1 legal lot. This, you know, subdivision plats are not cheap by any means. I don't know if anybody's ever gone through a process. You might know the figures. I'm not sure, but I know a subdivision plat can be in the thousands of dollars. And just to put an accessory building on an open area, it's not realistic in my opinion. And I think from that standpoint, we had to look at making some change somewhere. We did this recently down by Rolling Hills Subdivision in Maxwell. There was a property owner who wanted to buy a little additional piece of ground to put an accessory building on. He had to do a subdivision of the entire area instead of just a plat of survey getting that new lot. We've had a few instances where this has popped up, but what mainly triggered this change was there's an issue going on in Skycrest Subdivision right now where they want to do something like this, and we're trying to figure out an alternative for them. Since we were working on accessory regulations, we decided to bring this one forward. What we have looked at is I reached out to a few other counties within the state of Iowa to see how they deal with this particular issue. Surprisingly, most of them actually have some sort of regulations in there to help take care of it. What we got from Scott County and Blackhawk County was they use a covenant that both the property owner and the county would sign, more or less allowing for an accessory building to be built on an adjacent lot to the single-family dwelling. The covenants, I include a kind of a draft copy of what we were proposing, but more or less it ties those two together. It says that they can never be sold separately unless there's mutual consent from the property owner and the planning and development director. So that assures us that an accessory building isn't going to be built on a particular lot with no principal use on it and then sold off at some point in the future. So we just have an accessory building taking place on a property where the property owner doesn't even live close to it. Examples of when we would give mutual consent would be, again, if they're subdividing that off. If they take the accessory building down, for example, we'd give mutual consent to get out of that covenant because there'd be no longer an accessory building there. If there was a proposal to build a single-family dwelling on that and they were going to sell it off to somebody, we'd probably give consent to remove that covenant. Another reason why combining the lots doesn't work is from a standpoint when you're developing a subdivision, you usually review that based off how many houses are you going to put in that subdivision. Are you going to get the most use out of that piece of land as you can? And if we plan to have two lots in a certain area and we then shrink that down to one lot, again, we're removing the ability for further houses to be put onto that without doing another subdivision. So using this covenant actually helps us in not having to go through a subdivision process either time to get that taken care of. So that's kind of a summary of the problem that we've been having. Our recommendation on this was to add language to our exceptions and modifications chapter that said an accessory building may be built on adjoining lot, parcel, or tract if the adjoining lots, parcel, or tract are owned by the same property owner and said property owner signs a restrictive covenant agreeing not to sever the adjoining lots without the mutual consent of the director and the property owner. We think that that's going to alleviate a lot of that. One thing I did add to this, this has kind of been a sticking point for me for a while, but right now we don't even mention accessory buildings in our accessory uses for our zoning districts. We've obviously it's always been assumed that they're allowed, but just adding accessory buildings in that is probably going to just clarify our current practices. So two recommendations that we're making there is, again, to add language to the exception and modification and add language to each of our accessory regulations for our zoning districts to allow for accessory buildings. So if you, what's that?
Director?
Yes. Yes. Director is defined in our ordinance. So in this case, it would be me, but it also goes to my successors as well if I'm no longer here. Thank you. I'll take questions on each one of these individually instead of waiting for all of them at the end so we can...
Anybody else see any problems with this one?
No, just binds ownership so that you don't sell them separately, but doesn't require the legal redefinition. So.
And from what I've talked to with the people in Scott and Blackhawk County, they've found it to be a pretty successful tool. So.
Yeah. So if you're buying into a subdivision and you build your house on one, but you want to build a separate shop or separate garage and use the other space, then that allows you to use it effectively as one lot. So that makes sense.
We'd still assure that all setbacks are met from existing lot lines, too. I do want to point that out.
Yeah, regulations
so.
Would still yep. apply, but just the treatment of the allowance.
What do you envision as a situation in which you would let somebody out of that covenant?
The two things that come to mind is if the accessory building is ever torn down and they want to sell the lot separately, then obviously our interest in that covenant's gone. Second one would be, and this would be something, I don't know exactly how we would do it, but a certain property owner comes in and says, hey, I have Jane Doe wants to build a house on this lot, but she wants to also keep the accessory building, and I need the covenant removed before we sell it. I don't know exactly how we would do that, but that would be a situation where, hey, somebody is at least proposing to put a principal use on there. It's probably going to happen at some point in the future. We just need to be assured in some mechanism that it does take place. I'm sure, you know, if it does come down to it, we remove that covenant. We see no progress made. We can start an enforcement process because technically you have an accessory use taking place without a principal use, and that's a violation of our ordinance. Those are the two that come to mind, but, you know, some other stuff might come up, and we'd have to look at it. Mm-hmm. Any other questions on that one? Accessory dwellings, these are commonly referred to as granny flats. Most jurisdictions have these. When you have an aging or ailing family member, a lot of people want those aging or ailing family members closer to them so they can care for them. Granny flats is, you hear the name, obviously, that's why it gets the granny flat name, but they're just accessory dwellings, usually smaller buildings where, again, an elderly individual can live there, receive care from somebody in the principal structure, or vice versa. You know, the elderly might live in the principal structure and the caregiver might be living in the accessory unit. We've looked into this. The reason, and we're not recommending any changes, it's kind of a twofold reason right now. A, we do allow for what we call temporary mobile home permits on properties. Those are exactly what granny flats are meant to do. They're meant for, aging individuals to live in the trailer. We issue a temporary mobile home permit on there. We make them renew it every single year. We just had an instance with one where it's being removed right now. They didn't renew it this past year. That's how we can at least track and make sure that they're still being used how they're supposed to be used. The other one is we have what we call that residential parcel subdivision. It's a new process that we implemented not too long ago. In that case, if you have a single family dwelling currently on your land, you're able to divide that dwelling off the remainder of the land and create a second buildable lot on your land as long as you have at least 1 acre. 1 acre lot sizes come from just septic system issues and stuff that you need enough land to be able to do that, especially in the agricultural areas. So knowing that, that's where we're not recommending any changes. I think what we do currently really takes care of that problem. We're open for discussion on this one, too, but just based off the research that we've done, we don't get really any requests for this at all. The individual, Michelle Kassebaum, who sent the letter, and I included that in your packet, her asking for it had a lot to do with that type of situation. She wanted to build an accessory dwelling on her property. Came down to what she did is she just essentially built an addition onto her house, connected it to her garage, and again, that was just an addition to the existing principal structure, not a new accessory dwelling. So she found a way to meet our regulations and still get what she needed off of that. So I don't know if there is. Again, I'm open for discussion on this one. This really varies. It's kind of a hot topic planning issue, I think, across the country. But, again, I know we don't allow for accessory dwellings, but I think the feeling that we have from a staff standpoint is that we do offer a lot of options to meet this need.
This is kind of a pet issue of mine, and it's likely not to ever come to fruition until there's, until you have a line of people standing outside your door wanting to have an accessory dwelling. But I just think it's an opportunity for Story County to be innovative. I think that age dynamics in this country are changing rapidly. I think that 5 to 10 years from now, you're going to be getting more requests for temporary mobile homes scattered around the county than you would ever imagine or want. And I think that the temporary mobile home approach is kind of an unsatisfactory way of dealing with multi-generational households. I also think that there's an opportunity here to just to benefit the economy of the county, too, that property owners can have additional rent income. They can own a small farm and have labor actually live there as part of their compensation. So I think that that accessory dwellings generally get a bad rap for no particular reason other than we have a tradition of one house on one big lot in the United States. So it's something that maybe I would like to explore further, but I've got 5 years or something like that to work on that. So but we'll talk about it somewhere down the road when the demand increases. So,
yeah, and again, I don't want to say we didn't do too much research on these issues. We did discuss this pretty heavily at the staff level. Just kind of talked about what we're currently doing. The one question that we always have on this is, with the accessory dwelling is, how do you how do you enforce it after the fact? You're mentioning that obviously it provides an opportunity as a rental dwelling. The letter that Michelle Kassebaum included was, you know, you could open it up as a bed and breakfast, an accessory bed and breakfast, for example. A lot of options in there. But again, from an enforcement standpoint, I think that was some of our concern. However, if we are under the notion that we're not worried about, you know, two families living on one parcel, then that wouldn't be an issue. But again, and as you had mentioned, it's been a longstanding policy where we allow one house per parcel, and going away from that right now, at least just based off this change that we're making, I'm not sure it's appropriate. But again, there can be a much larger discussion that takes place to the issue. So.
I think Story County would be stepping far outside its comfort zone.
No, that's very
fair. So, you know, it's not something I think that's going to happen in one discussion like this with nobody in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of urban, dense urban places that still don't allow accessory dwellings. That's changing, but, again, Story County would be leading the way for a rural area to allow accessory dwellings.
You know, I reached out to a lot of counties on a few of these issues, and I want to find...
Have you found any rural county?
Yep, and that's
any county that allows accessory dwellings?
No. I'm just trying to go through all the responses that I got here real quick. There was one county that did. I want to say it was Johnson County, but I don't know. Cerro Gordo County does. Johnson County does. Yes, Cerro Gordo is Mason City.
I don't want to be naive here, but what is the objection? Shanty shack?
It's just the, again, we have a longstanding policy of one family, one dwelling per parcel, and again, going away from that. Again, in our opinion, I'm not necessarily opposed to the idea. It's going to take a lot more research and a lot more discussion before we ever get to that point.
If I own a tenant house, which I rented at that time from the owners who were personal friends, but I don't see any problem.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, Joseph, it's always been done that way.
And I hate that response, I really do, but it is fact.
Well, we've always done it that way.
There were a lot of tenant houses.
Well, another thing to note is with the agricultural exemption in the state of Iowa that you know, we didn't get zoning in this county until 1958. So anything that happened prior to 1958. It was kind of free for all. Do whatever you want as far as zoning goes. Real quick, though, Cerro Gordo and Johnson County, they do allow it. They allow it by a conditional use permit.
Okay.
So.
And I would guess that even those counties, they're looking at it as a means for caring for an infirmed relative, whereas I think we're going to see a transition over the next decade of it's just a lifestyle a choice for families to live in multi-generational groups. But still want some privacy.
Get out of the basement, but you can have your own little house next door, you know.
Well, that's another thing, you know, boomerang kids, go off, you know.
Yeah.
We're just seeing that's the dynamic, you know, the North American Home Builders Association is, or the National Association of Home Builders has noticed this trend. And if you add to it the potential for, I think, a resurgence in small farms and more diversified farms that require more hand labor, more interns, you know, and we're in a university area that kicks out a lot of agriculture students. I just think we're headed that way. But if I'm right, that dynamic will force our hand in the future. You don't have trouble with the temporary mobile homes, keeping track of them and making sure they're removed eventually.
We've got three or four of them right now. And is that all we have in the database? Because that one...
I believe we had four, and it's going down to three. That one.
There's not many. Every so often we get a request for them, and they're there. That also doesn't mean that there's not some out there that we don't know about. That happens all the time. So.
Just as a comment, I would just as soon see a permanent structure as a mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
Me too. But going back to it's always been that way. That's the best reason in the world to look at it now so that we are ready as opposed to getting slammed up.
Mm-hmm.
Because of it's a generational thing. And so
on. Yep.
So I think that it should be definitely kept on the bucket list. I don't know what you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Work,
the planning director bucket list.
But also, you know, I think that it would be appropriate to take it up to the Board of Supervisors so that they're aware of this is something we're looking at doing, and we want your input. We want the input of all of the other departments within the Story County. And also, you could even take it to the little small towns we've got around, because they're going to be impacted too.
Do you have a place where you keep track of possible agenda items for the next joint meeting?
No, but I will.
This could very well go on it, and then we would be sure it will come up again.
I have a place somewhere up here, and I'll keep it up there.
What's the age of our comprehensive plan right now? When was the last update?
2003, I believe.
2003.
We have an RFP out right now. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I am not aware of that.
We'll discuss that later then.
Okay. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing that when you have public input for an update to the comprehensive plan, that's the sort of thing that if that trend is out there and that demand is out there, that should rise to the surface. Mm-hmm. And that would be a good...
Yeah. And it's not a comprehensive plan either. It's a land use plan. It doesn't get too comprehensive. It gets comprehensive as far as the land use issue, but as far as other issues, it's not comprehensive at all. So we'll get there further. That's a separate issue right now.
Don't we have a spot that says old business toward the bottom of the agenda?
Staff and commission comments.
Right. Staff, okay.
I'll pitch you on it.
Staff comments.
Let's keep going on. Go ahead. Finish your thought, and then let's proceed.
Nancy, to your comment that when we do take this to the supervisors, depending on what the recommendation is, I'll make sure that they're well aware of the commission's comments, and we'll forward those on to them. So, any other thing on the accessory dwellings? Good. Accessory towers. This one comes off a lot of inquiries that we've had recently for property owners putting, what would you say, Ryan, they're about 80 to 100-foot towers typically that the requests are for rural broadband, as I will call it. You know, the governor's office is making a huge push to get broadband out in rural areas. We're getting an increase in demand on this particular issue. You know, can I put up a tower on my property to receive broadband? Currently, right now, we have an exception in our regulations, and I think I put the exception here in the memo. I just want to get it right, but it currently states that chimneys, cooling towers, elevator bulkheads, fire towers, monuments, water towers, churches, ornamental towers, spires, telephone, radio, or television towers are necessary mechanical appendages may be erected to a height in excess of existing district regulations of Story County, provided, however, if it's close to an airport, that doesn't take place. So with that, we, you know, over the past few months, once we noticed that this exception was in there, we've kind of, as far as a communication tower, we've considered these broadband towers to be communication towers. They are communicating in some way. Problem is that they have to meet the accessory use setbacks, which is a 10-foot side yard setback, a 2-foot rear setback. You're putting a 100-foot tower on there. Not to say that tower is ever going to fall down, but if it does fall down and it's within 2 feet of your rear property line, it's obviously going onto the neighboring properties. Recently, a few years ago, Ryan worked pretty hard on the wind tower, the small non-commercial wind tower accessory use that we put in. We put in some very specific setback requirements, some very specific height requirements for that. Our feeling is that putting a new accessory use in our regulations in the A1, the A2, the AR, the R1, the R2, the commercial light industrial and the heavy industrial zoning districts to allow for towers, very similar to those regulations in which we did a lot of research on, would be appropriate. So if there's any further questions on that, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are these type of towers, do they have guy wires?
I don't know for sure. I would imagine that you're going to kind of see varying requests. I'm sure you'll have some guide wires. You probably have some lattice towers as well in there, just kind of depending on the height, depending on how much money they want to invest in the tower.
Correct. I mean, I assume the guy wires have to fit inside the property boundary, and the setbacks are going to apply to that. And so,
the setbacks would not apply to that?
What's that now?
Where the guy wires come down, okay, the guy wires just have to be inside the property line, or do they have to be an additional 10 feet or whatever it is inside the property line?
I think it's every portion of... That's how we've looked at it in the past, I believe, is every portion of the tower. So I think the guy wires also would have to be within setbacks.
I would assume so, because the guy wires have some sort of a foundational anchor, mm-hmm. and that's a, you know,
so you still need, so you still need 10 feet.
Whatever the requirements.
Whatever the feet are. Feet. And right now, is there a maximum height?
It is 80 feet if the property is... Property between 1/2 acre and 1 acre, it's 80 feet. Above 1 acre, it's there is no height limitation. However, we have to look at any height limitations as imposed by the FAA, and also you have to be set back 115% of the total tower height. So that's going to dictate, depending on where you locate it, how high of a tower you can have. We also do allow for an exception where towers can be 100% or setback 100%. Or how is that written? If there's an easement that the adjacent property owner grants to the property owner asking for the tower, they can have a tower setback 100% of the total height. They can have the tower placed so it is not any more or any less than 100% of the total height from an adjacent property owner's structure.
Structure.
Yeah, not the property line, the structure. So if there's a, you know, a house there, if there's a shed there or anything like that, as long as you're set back 100% of that tower height from that structure, you can place it. You also have to get an easement from your neighbor, kind of like a fall zone easement.
So if you've got a 150-foot tower, you got to set it back 150.
From if you have that, if you have that easement from your neighbor, you have to have it 150 feet back from the structure. If you don't, it has to be 115%, which would be what, 167? Yeah. I can't do the math off the top of my head.
But what if there's no structure?
Good point. If there's no structure, yeah, you could put it anywhere, I guess, on the property as long as at least the fall zone easement. Yeah. You still have to meet the normal setback requirements. Yeah. The normal accessory, so you couldn't be within 10 feet, anything like that. But if there's not a structure and it falls down, I mean, it is falling on vacant ground, so. And okay. That comes a. Oh, you're thinking, I see what you're doing. I know the issues come up with you, so it is something that we need to work on, and I think you can attest to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's no big whoopee if you know, we got a 10-foot deal, but it is a big whoopee. If we've got a 500-foot deal,
mm-hmm.
as to proper placement.
And again, this is just for non-commercial towers. Anything that would be commercialized still has to go through a conditional use permit process. We're not getting out of that at all. So.
Okay, so a personal, a non-commercial electric generator, wind tower, whatever you want to call it, non-commercial, that would be considered personal. And so that would fall into this.
Yeah, it doesn't fall into this because we have separate requirements for that. But the requirements are going to be very similar to that.
Okay. All right.
There's a few things that we took out from that one to this one, and it mainly had to do with getting cooperation from whoever the electrical district is in that area, just making sure that they're aware of the tower going in there. A lot of engineering and stuff like that that has to take place with those towers wouldn't be included with this, but the regulations are pretty similar.
Okay, broadband tower, do you consider that commercial or?
Well, if you know, there's an example I know of one subdivision in this county that has one up there currently where it is bringing in a signal from that tower and dispersing it to all the houses in the subdivision. Somebody is, you know, obviously it's commercialized because people are paying a fee, user fee, to get the thing off that. So that's at what point we would consider it commercial.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there isn't any such thing as a broadband tower that stands by itself and serves no other purpose, is there?
Well, again, a broadband tower for an individual home is what we're really aiming here. So if somebody wants to put up a tower on their property to receive a signal from another tower somewhere that's a commercial tower, that's what we're looking at.
Okay.
kind of similar there, you know, a lot of times back in the day with TV, we used to have those TV antennas on people's property that would stick way up to get the signal, and that's something similar to what we're looking at here. And I'm sure the technology at some day is going to outdate itself, and those aren't going to be necessary anymore, but...
Charlie, I'm not seeing any actual ordinance language change. Is it because you would just add a notation in some table somewhere?
If you look at our summary of recommendations on the
last page
of there, that's where I kind of, I didn't want to duplicate because it's a lot of language in there, and I didn't want to duplicate it, so it's placed in there.
Okay,
number
thank
five.
You. Yep, thank you. Any other questions on accessory towers?
Bed and breakfast. This was another one based off the letter that we got from Mrs. Kassebaum on the issue. We did look into it. You know, I'll be honest, this is something other than the letter that we got from her that has never come up. It's never been a concern. We currently allow for bed and breakfast as long as there's no more than two additional families in the house. That's allowed through a home business permit. Anything above two families is considered a bed and breakfast inn. That is allowed by a conditional use permit. However, both of those need to take place in the structure that the proprietor is living in. It can't be a separate structure. This main inquiry was, if I have an accessory dwelling on my property, I want to be able to use it for a bed and breakfast. Since we're not recommending any changes to accessory dwellings right now, we're not also recommending any changes to the bed and breakfast language. But again, down the road, if we get into that type of discussion, this would also be something that we'd want to look at.
What if it's a grandfathered in accessory structure?
Yeah, it wouldn't.
Like a pre-1958.
Yep. Right now, we wouldn't allow for it, you know. I'm trying to think if there's a way that you could get around it, and I can't think of a way that you can necessarily get around it. It would have to be something that obviously the Board of Adjustment would have to review a conditional use permit and give grant to it, not following regulations. It would be a use variance, which isn't allowed in this county. I'm not sure there's a way around it without coming forward with a code amendment. But again, we've never had that request. Doesn't mean that we're never going to get it, but if we do ever get such a request, I think from staff standpoint, we would say you need to go through and propose language.
So the request that you got was actually to add an accessory building that they could, it's not
yep.
to use.
They wanted to add a granny flat on their property and then be protected in the future when that granny flat was no longer being used to have it allowable for other uses.
Okay. So you're saying currently, even if a bed and breakfast is on its own lot, it has to be occupied permanently by the operator of the bed and breakfast?
Your definitions, yes.
I'd have to give some thought as to why that's necessary. But it, I mean, I haven't thought of all the...
It's just the definition of a bed and breakfast. Otherwise, it's a hotel.
It's a hotel.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that
It's
part.
Not a residence any longer.
If I wanted to turn my barn into a bed and breakfast, I couldn't do it.
Not based off our current regulations.
Unless you moved into the barn.
Unless what?
Unless you moved into the barn.
Okay.
I don't know if we'd allow that, though. It depends. If both you and your husband would have to move into the barn and probably tear the other house down, or at least change the use.
It does seem to be tied in with the other issue, though, of accessories
yes,
as well.
Yes, yeah, I agree with that 100%. And that's
I think
we
the request that he got is exactly what you were talking about before.
Yep.
Yes.
It is.
I want to... accessory residence.
I want to rent it
be
out.
Be able to use it in the future after it's...
I might want to rent it out by the night, not by the...
Easy.
Well. I'm going shorter than I have.
I wonder how far you were going to take that.
Any other questions on that? This next one is something that we have been getting questions on for... Mm-hmm. years now. Small animals and livestock allowed in the R1, the R2, and the AR zoning district. Currently, we have a definition of livestock. We only allow livestock in the A1 and the A2. There's a what I would consider to be an urban chicken movement that's taking place across this country. People want to have, you know, a couple chickens on their property, get the eggs for personal use, not commercial use. It does kind of extend past chickens in some instances. You know, you can be looking at goats. I even read that some jurisdictions allow for pigs to be kept in people's backyards. There's an extension of animals that I think you can look at. Really, we've only dealt with the inquiries on chickens, which is at this point why we are only recommending to change the chicken language, or to change the language to allow for chickens. I did have a pretty lengthy conversation with Sue McCaskey, our animal control director, on this, because I, you know, first of all, wanted to get kind of her blessing on allowing something like this. She's definitely in favor of it. We've dealt with some instances in some subdivisions where it is taking place. We know it's taking place. Technically, it's a use that's not allowed, but we don't have the enforcement capability to go after all of them right now. This one particular instance, and you'll see this is why it says no male poultry shall be prohibited, or male poultry should be prohibited. We had a rooster that was waking neighbors up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and it became an issue, and we had to get it alleviated pretty fast because people calling in like crazy. So this one, I wouldn't mind having a pretty, good discussion on it. If you want us to do any further looking into it, we can. Like I said, as of right now, we're really only going with allowing for poultry, prohibiting roosters, male poultry, capping it off at 8 poultry total, making sure that the poultry are stored in an adequate pen of at least 5 square feet per poultry. That's really based off the recommendation from our animal control director. Also adding that the pen shall be set back at least 30 feet from the nearest neighboring dwelling, just to make sure that we do have a little bit extra setback in those instances. Lastly, making sure that any proposal to put chickens on your property would fully comply with our animal control and welfare ordinance. Again, I don't know if there's ever been any thought on this one by the commission. Me and Ms. McCaskey did kind of talk about goats a little bit. To me, that's, I didn't recommend that because I didn't know exactly how far we wanted to go. I kind of wanted to build some discussion here and see what the commission was comfortable with.
So is poultry more than just chickens? And what else does it include?
It can include geese, turkeys.
Sorry. According to the dictionary, it includes chickens, turkeys, ducks, or geese.
It definitely can extend beyond that, and I did take that into account, but I wasn't sure exactly how big of a deal that would be.
There is still the restriction regarding the size of the lots, right, in all of these areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The AR, however, you can have the lot can be a lot bigger.
The AR minimum lot size is 1 acre, so it has to be at least an acre.
Right. The R1 and the R2, the minimum is?
The R1 is 25,000 square feet. The R2 is 10,000 square feet. Let me double check that.
You mentioned that earlier.
We have. And I'll be honest with you right now.
Is that less than an acre? Is that more than an acre?
That's less. That's less.
An eighth of an acre.
1 acre is 43,560 square feet.
Quarter of an acre.
Quarter of an acre. I don't know what the right one.
The R2 is 8,000 square feet for single-family dwellings. So.
City of Ames allows backyard chickens.
Talk with the City of Ames actually on this because I thought they did as well. They don't necessarily have anywhere in their ordinance where they say we allow for chickens. They just also don't prohibit them. They really rely on their animal control department to kind of enforce on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but what do they enforce if they don't have
nuisance codes? Again, if you have a male chicken on there that's making a lot of noise, it's a nuisance. They'll come take care of it. Again, to be quite honest, if we could say in our language that, hey, we allow for poultry, and a lot of the other stuff that's in here, the no more than 8, making sure that setback, an adequate pen, is really kind of covered in that animal control and welfare ordinance. That's why I included it in your packet. But my thought was, we might as well just mention it in our language if that's what we really want. But a lot of the stuff that we're mentioning here is covered in that Chapter 45.
I would just say because you're now keeping regulations in two places, right? You're mentioning it, and then it's mm-hmm. also it says it shall comply. But I would say you want to make sure and identify which shall take precedent.
Yeah. Right? But and if you look through Chapter 45, a lot of the language in there I would call pretty broad. It just states, you should make sure that, right, the living conditions are favorable. I don't know what the exact...
That's fine. I just want to say that if that Chapter 45 gets updated, right, if there's changes made to that based on animal control, my question is who's going to have the right of way, right? Who's going to have a more authority on the topic? And so
I hope if that does ever happen
in this area, I would say we would defer to animal control and welfare, and that's what I would probably say is, defer to animal control where their ordinances are more prohibitive or more restrictive.
Where in conflict, the more stringent shall apply.
Yeah, where in conflict,
the stricter.
Yeah,
that's fine with me, actually.
It does seem odd that, I can see why you get tons of calls about it, because people see chicken coops in the yards in the city of Ames, and they find out they can't have one out in the country. Also, I think, most of the R1 and R2 lots are within rural subdivisions, which can create their own restrictive covenants if they wanted to prohibit chickens.
Yep, that was mentioned, and I'll be honest, most of them do, even though we don't allow for them.
Right.
Right. What was the development that went up out in out off Cameron School Road, 500? Was it Cameron Estates?
Yeah, Cameron Estates. Yep.
Yeah. Remember, they had a restrictive covenants that, even though it was outside of, I don't remember, but they did mention no livestock, no horses, no,
Did they take it down to chickens?
They did not. I mean, they allowed chickens, but
they were
restrictive beyond what ordinance covered.
But if you did say no livestock, depending on how you would interpret the definition of livestock, our definition of livestock does cover poultry. So
I would think so. I sort of am trying to wrap my mind around having an eighth of an acre and having eight chickens in the backyard.
I try to wrap my mind around the whole concept. And when we first moved to Ames, the people next door to us on the north had a farm. They had cows. They had some pasture land in back. And it seemed to me that this was almost as good as not being in town. But if you're going to live in town, you live in one way. And if you're going to live in the country, you live in another way. And I don't get it. But, however... I don't understand why anybody would ever want to have chickens.
That's another issue, though, Susan.
It does. And then that's why we're looking at them.
I would expect that if we open up public input sessions at a comprehensive plan discussion, that we'll hear a lot of this sort of stuff, and that might be a great time to discuss it further. To me, this is a pretty good. To me, it's a pretty logical step. One question, non-commercial. If I'm eight chickens means at least eight eggs a day, right? So if I've got a farm fresh eggs for sale sign out at my yard,
and I'm not an expert on chickens, from what I did read too, the older the chickens get, they don't necessarily lay once a day. It can be once every 20 hours or something like that. This is something that we did talk about with the animal control director, and I think she said eight was probably adequate depending on your household size. Eight might even be necessary. Who knows? We don't limit. Obviously, we don't have regulations that say you can only have two kids. So.
Farmer's market or something, take them.
We can take them. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and the non-commercial portion is just mainly, don't sell from your property, don't, stuff like that. So. Yeah, and Ryan did point out, too, real quick, that our AR zoning district does allow for horses as well. Currently, it does allow for stables. Our R1 and R2 does not allow for that, but we've at least got that.
Cameron Estates, though, they did.
Yep, and again, there is a lot of covenants.
I think it was zoned AR, and so they could have done horses, but their covenants said no.
Fair to note, too, and I'm sure you guys all know this, if somebody put a horse on their property out there, there's nothing we would do about it. We'd civil issue covenant, on the covenants, right. So just want to at least point that out. It's good to remind you every so often.
Thank you.
Okay. These are very interesting charges.
I wouldn't vote against it. I'm not.
Anything else on the small animals and small livestock?
Okay, is that the...
Last one that I have on here is what we consider unpermitted structures. And I'll just simply point out that in order to alleviate our review and inspection of small, inexpensive buildings and ornamental structures, we're recommending adding language to our exceptions and modifications that states accessory structures which are less than 100 square feet and have no permanent attachment to the underlying ground shall not require a zoning permit. However, all bulk requirements of the applicable zoning district shall be satisfied. You know,
it's like sheds and...
There's a lot of things. We get into the point where a lot of people want to put small structures in front of their or by their driveways to keep their kids out of conditions when they why they wait for the bus, stuff like that. Okay. Playhouses in the past technically require a zoning permit for them. We require a zoning permit for anything that's really a structure. There's a lot of things involved in getting a zoning permit. We take their money in. It's usually a $30 permit, not too much. There's a good probably hour's worth of staff review, probably about another hour going out and inspecting that it meets all setback requirements. You know, for structures that are this small and really have no impact, it's almost a waste of time to do it. So, you know, we're not saying that, hey, you don't pay attention to zoning regulations. We're saying, hey, you know, you still need to pay attention to zoning regulations. But honestly, these are structures that aren't even assessed. So,
yeah. That's true.
I don't know why we're requiring zoning permits for them. You know, and I did talk to the assessor's office as well because I kind of wanted to see if there was a break point on when they started assessing buildings. There isn't anything kind of etched in stone. It's kind of just dependent on, you know, what they view it as. But I did run this language past them, and they thought it was pretty good language. So.
Now, what does have no permanent attachment to the underlying ground?
No foundation. You know, if a shed's put on a cement concrete slab and then attached to it, that would require a permit. You know, something that, to be quite honest, is a little bit more permanent where if we did find out, you know, yeah, we didn't require a permit, but you're within 5 feet of the side property line, you need to move it back. Well, if it's permanently attached to the ground, that's a little bit harder to do. So if it's not permanently attached to the ground, we can at least get it moved a little bit easier. It's
so.
Just...
concrete post holes or something,
yep.
You could dig out or whatever, that's no big deal, but you pour a foundation, then that's a
okay.
problem.
Well, the concrete post holes, we would probably still say that that is an attachment to the ground based off this definition. But
corkscrew anchors?
I would
cable
yeah,
down, probably.
No, I wouldn't go that yeah. far. I think, you know, typically we look at it as if there's concrete involved in holding it down, I think that's when it's permanently attached to the ground. I know when we did the sign ordinance, if you remember, that's kind of what we had discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? So we have a bunch of issues put together here in one agenda item.
And you can separate them if you would like. We can move off. Again, the staff recommendation, I put that summary of recommendation on there. That's all included on there. That's all included with the ones I'm showing you here up on the screen. There's a lot of language there. If you agree with everything we're saying, it's probably decent to just do one motion, but if you want to separate them out and make some changes.
Okay. And we are going to, we do need to have an actual public hearing on this, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
We do?
Because this is a legislative change we're proposing, and we
this
eventually.
This is a legislative change?
However, we are making a
ordinance is considered a legislative action.
We are still just making a recommendation on that change, on a proposed change to the Board of Supervisors. But, okay. So, eventually, we will be looking for a motion on a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. For right now, if there's no other questions from the Commission, then we'll open the public hearing to hear from the public. Do we need a time on that? 5:20 p.m. Any comments from the public? Nothing submitted by email or otherwise.
You're the public, so.
I noticed earlier you said there's nobody in the room.
I will mention that I did run an email to Michelle Casabon since the letter that she submitted was almost, now probably 15 months old, and just kind of let her know what our recommendation was going to be. Didn't hear anything back from her. However, if she does want to provide comment, again, this still has to go through the Board of Supervisors,
mm-hmm.
which require 3 public hearings unless they find it necessary to waive any of those.
Right.
Okay.
I
need.
Well, we have no comments from the public, so we're going to close the public hearing 2 minutes later.
5:22.
And we'll entertain a motion from the Commission on a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors.
I make a motion that we recommend it to the Board of Supervisors so that they can move forward with the planning of a public meeting to finalize, formalize and finalize these changes.
Got that, Kristen? Yeah? Okay, do we have a second?
A second.
Any discussion on the motion? Okay. Then we'll have a roll call vote.
Miller?
Yes.
Donaldson? Wendt?
Yes.
Steele?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Very good. We are on to item number 9, comments from the staff.
Few things that I will mention again. I think we had put out about a month ago about that Iowa State training available. Scott, I think you did reply that you wanted to go to that, and we'll eventually get you signed up. I just wanted to remind everybody that if you want to attend, we do get a discount if we have more than, I think, 5 people attend.
What was the ISU?
It's pretty much what Iowa State Extension calls Planning and Zoning 101. It's just almost a basic refresher course of kind of the commission and the Board of Adjustments responsibilities. I didn't bring the information with me, but it's a 2 or 3 hour long training. They do provide you dinner. It's located in various locations around the state. I think the closest one to Story County is either Fort Dodge or Johnston, Iowa. But yeah, we've got budget to send every single one of you if you want to go.
Is it only 2 or 3 hours?
I don't remember.
I'll get.
If you can resend. I know that yep. You did send it, and I did look at it, and I didn't respond. When is it?
When?
March 23rd, Council Bluffs. March 24th, Fort Dodge. 30th, Dubuque. March 31st, Waterloo. April 6th, Davenport. April 7th, Fairfield. And April 13th, Johnston.
Yes, but it's yeah, only 2 or 3 hours?
What's the time on there?
They begin with registration and a light supper at 5:30 p.m. Program begins at 6 and concludes by 8:45.
That's hardly enough to. We had a longer training session when we had that fella come in.
And Gary Taylor, he's the one who actually does this.
Oh, really?
Yep. In the past, we've paid for him to come here. It's about the same amount of money as to just pay all of you to attend this one. So
I'm interested in doing it. I'll just need to. If you could resend that.
Yep, I will send it back out to everybody.
And then I'll just. Do we have to tell you which one we're going to?
Yeah, I'm going to have to work on that because if there is, I'll work on that with Iowa State Extension. But, yeah, at least let me know which one you want to go to, and I'll put that together. And
give you a couple of preferences. Sure.
I've heard Gary do this before, and he's excellent at it. No, it covers a lot really, of really legal good, background yeah. stuff about, you know, keeping records and the appropriate way to make motions. And
am I the only one left down here that went through that with him?
You might have been.
I'm sure you are because my seniority is next year, so
I
did not.
I want to know how you got a shorter tenure.
Well, because I stepped into somebody's vacated position is what I've been told. It was a vacated
works,
position.
Yeah. We try, and I'll get into that. Actually, that's a good transition to my next point. I know some of you might have saw the email last night that Dave Struthers sent, but he has officially given his resignation. To the Planning and Zoning Commission, so we are going to be looking for a 7th Planning and Zoning Commission member. This particular one, we are required by state code to have a majority of our commissioners be unincorporated citizens. I believe 4 of you up there right now are unincorporated citizens. Nancy Kauser is also unincorporated, so we've met that. We also have to provide gender balance, so we have to have at least 3 women be on there, and we currently have 3 women on there. So this position, which is very helpful for Story County, is that it can be anybody in the county as long as they live here.
Anyone with a heartbeat.
Yes.
Any county resident.
There's a lot of times we have to make sure it's a woman or a man, you know. We never have to make sure. We could have all women, but we have to sometimes make sure we get it a woman, or sometimes that we make sure that it's an unincorporated resident. So if you know anybody within Story County, please tell them to apply if they would be interested. We'll try to do some outreach from our end as well. But I was pretty excited that we had all our Board of Adjustment and Planning and Zoning Commission slots filled because it doesn't happen too often, and it ended pretty fast as well. So
who do they contact if they're interested?
The Board of Supervisors would probably be the best contact. If they want to apply, have them just contact our office, and we'll get them set up with the application. You can also get the application online, I think, somewhere. But
just call Charlie.
Yeah, call me.
Just call Charlie.
I'll help him out. There was something I wanted to add to that when I said that was a good transition, and now it escaped my mind. Probably not that important then. Lastly, from my standpoint, we are going to be hiring a summer intern this summer to help mainly with what we are calling a comprehensive plan. We say rewrite, but it's kind of a new comprehensive plan. Leanne, my former predecessor, obviously is working pretty hard on this from the special project standpoint. We've got an RFP out right now. I don't know exactly when the RFP is due. It's coming up sometime this month. I do know that. But we're planning on having a firm come in into a comprehensive plan, right, for us to be very comprehensive, to deal with many issues, not just land use. We're bringing an intern in to kind of help us from a staff standpoint alleviate some of the work that it's going to take to get this done. If you guys know anybody, any students involved in planning anywhere, let them know about the internship, and we'd be happy to look them over. So,
have you put the notice out to that curriculum at Iowa State?
Yep.
And DMAC?
It's on our website. It's on the American Planning Association's national website, by my mistake, but we're going to leave it there for now. It's going to be on the state chapter's website, and it's also on Iowa State Career Services website.
Okay.
So, and I don't know if there's any questions on the comprehensive plan we're calling. It's Cornerstone to Capstone. If you remember, Leanne loves acronyms, so it's
yes.
The C2C plan. That's what it will be commonly referred to. And as we go through this project, I'm going to keep you updated. I have recommended that when we do put together the project team, that we have at least one member from the Planning and Zoning Commission on that project team. It might be more than that, too, so we'll see where we go from there.
Is this the strategic plan?
No.
No, that's a different plan.
The strategic plan will hopefully be a component of the overall comprehensive plan. The interesting thing with Story County is that we actually do have quite a few plans out there that would fit into a comprehensive plan. So we're hoping that there isn't going to be too much work needed to be done on this, just reference to other plans. Our conservation board currently is working on a parks and trail plan. That's going to be a component of the comprehensive plan, obviously. Our county development plan would be a component of the comprehensive plan. I am hoping that we can have a complete overhaul of our land use plan, because our land use plan, to put it nicely, is not good. So.
And so what Leanne's working on is the strategic or the comprehensive?
Both. Her hours, she's mainly doing the strategic plan. The comprehensive plan, I can show you, we have a worksheet that kind of, a lot of the upfront work, selecting the consultant, doing the RFP process, is handled through Leanne. As we slowly get through the process down to the implementation of the comprehensive plan, that is completely taken over by our department. So we'll be heavily involved in the end. Leanne's heavily involved in the beginning. We'll be minorly involved in the beginning. She'll be minorly involved in the end.
Okay. Any other staff comments?
Regarding the CWEPS issue, and I don't know if Ryan wants to add anything to this, we had preliminarily put this on your agenda for tonight. To be quite honest, we needed more time to look over some stuff, so I think we're planning on getting that back next month, possibly, but we are working through.
This is the financial security issue related to this.
Oh, for the towers? Okay.
Yeah, you weren't. I can talk to you kind of about what we talked about last month. Listen to the audio. There's
yeah, I listened to most of it. I kind of did a few fast forwards, but.
All right. Anything else? Commission comments. Susan? Anything? Okay.
I make a motion we adjourn.
Second? Anyone?
Second.
We are adjourned. Thanks, everybody.